We are going to start the program today thinking again about the killings last weekend in Isla Vista, California. And like other tragedies we've witnessed across the country, this has us thinking a lot about mental health. According to authorities, Elliot Rogers saw multiple mental health professionals throughout his life. He was even visited by law enforcement, all this before he killed six people and wounded 13 others. But he also left a robust explanation of his state of mind in the form of a lengthy YouTube rant where he described his rage at women for not being more attractive attracted to him, and at minorities whom he considered inferior but somehow more socially successful. So we thought we'd like to spend some time thinking about what this tragedy might teach us about mental health treatment and policy. And we've called two people who have had occasion to consider this issue before. Ron Hohnberg is Director of Policy and Legal Affairs at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. He's with us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Once again, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Also joining us once again is Dr. Carl Bell. He's a staff psychiatrist at Jackson Park Hospital Family Medicine Clinic. That's in Chicago. He joins us from there. Dr. Bell has a deep background in treating the effects of violence and has also done extensive research into the psychological ramifications of extreme racism. So we're glad to have him back with us as well. Dr. Bell, welcome back.
Thank you.
So Dr. Bell, let me start with you. I of course recognize you've never treated this young man. You never saw him. But just from the public record that he left, what comes to your mind? What occurs to you?
Well, based on the records, he obviously was having psychiatric problems. One of the, I think, important things is that he was being adequately monitored by the people who loved him, his parents. And because of that, they were able to recognize the potential danger that he was exhibiting and ultimately, you know, fulfilled.
But they said that they couldn't. When he was first, when they first contacted authorities, it was, I think it was a couple of months ago, he had not at that point raised any specific threats, but they were clearly alarmed by what they were hearing from him. Is there anything else that one can do in a situation like that?
Well, you know, the whole issue of dangerousness and mental illness is very complex, multi-determined. Unfortunately, what most people do in our society is that they shun and they stigmatize people that are mentally ill, which leaves them unmonitored. And as a result of being unmonitored, they're kind of off on their own doing whatever it is they're doing. There's it's a double-edged sword because on the one hand, you've got civil liberties and you want people to be able to be free and do what they need to do. But on the other hand, you've got issues of dangerousness and sometimes the need to force treatment on people if they're dangerous to self or others. And that line gets fuzzy.
What do you think they should have done differently? Is there anything that you think that they could? And let me just be clear. We are not judging this family because we don't know an awful lot about what they may have done or how deeply involved that they were. And they clearly were involved to the point of making sure that
they were involved
in treatment. They clearly were. But
sure.
So we're not judging them. I just want to be very clear on that. But
sure.
Do you think that they should have made... he was living independently. Do you he was living apart from his parents. He was living with roommates. Do you think that they should have taken steps to what? Keep searching his belongings to make sure that they were... What do you think?
That's a little bit invasive. And when you're like that with people who have issues, psychiatric issues, they resent it. They feel they're not being treated with dignity or respect. So again, I didn't really get much that they were doing wrong or out of sort. They were been taking care of their son and monitoring him and trying to do the best they could for him. But again, as a grown man, he's got the legal rights to refuse care. And apparently that's what happened. And then when you add the confusion that the authorities have when to judge somebody as dangerous and when to act, it gets really messy.
Ron Hohnberg, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, can you, obviously, I believe the laws differ from place to place, but is there some general rule about when a family member can step in and ask for a more direct intervention based on concerns that they are that they see in a person's behavior or speech?
Well, Michelle, two points I'd like to make about that. First of all, Dr. Bell is absolutely correct. It is very, very difficult to get someone whose symptoms may be so severe that they don't recognize their need for help. It's very difficult to get help for that person. The laws are not only they not only differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, they're very complicated. They oftentimes involve multiple procedures. And it's more than the laws. The fact is that in many parts of the country, most parts of the country, the mental health system is not adequately equipped to respond to the needs of people. So there may not be hospital beds available. We heard that in the case of Cray Deeds' son.
Former state senator in Virginia whose son grievously wounded him and then killed himself.
Correct, yes. And the mental health system is very much a downstream system. So because of lack of resources, it waits until people are in crisis before it responds.
So is the triggering event generally that he would have had to have made a specific threat? I'm going to do X, Y, or Z. He did at one point make a specific threat, but that was... But apparently his therapist and his parents found out about it too late to stop him. By the time they found out about it, he was already in the middle of his plans.
Well, that really feeds into the second point I wanted to make is think about it. We ask law enforcement to be the judges. We ask, and this is true not just in Santa Barbara. This is true across the country. And many law enforcement agencies have actually trained their police on how to de-escalate psychiatric crises. But we're asking police officers to make the kind of judgments that are very, very complicated that we really need trained mental health professionals to make. And that, I think, is very much illustrated. The problems with that are very much illustrated in this case.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought for a minute, Ron Hornberg, and give us some clues about how you think policy could be more helpful in this area. But Dr. Bell, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know you've done research in this area, he displayed some very hateful views toward both women and other minorities in his public utterances. I mean, is there a point at which you feel that the kind of animus he displayed both toward women for who he says were not attracted to him in the way that he felt he deserved to be, and for other minorities, the hatred that he expressed toward other minorities when he felt that they were more socially successful than him, even though he felt himself superior to them, is there something that you think should have occasioned a more aggressive intervention? Because one of the things that's been interesting to us is how many people have written that those kinds of utterances are actually fairly common among some young people who feel socially frustrated.
Yeah.
So what crosses a line for you?
It's the whole issue around racism and whether or not it might be a psychiatric disorder is really extraordinarily complex. Probably 98% of it is learned behavior. But, we did a chapter a couple of years ago in the Oxford Textbook of Personality, and maybe 2% it has a psychiatric base, where people are paranoid or they're manic, and they go off on these tirades about various people that are different. But again, these are very murky waters, so it's messy.
Is there anything you think could have been done or that you would like to see done or that you would like us to be thinking about as a consequence of what we have now learned, Dr.
Well, I think that, if we could fix the mental health system, that would be wonderful. But it is a downstream system. It's the last thing to get funding. If we could do more prevention, I think we'd be better off. And then the whole issue of, even if it had been a mental health person involved in evaluating him, he still might have lied through his teeth and said, oh, no, I'm just fine, when really he wasn't just fine. And mental health people, the police, we're not lie detectors, so that makes it more complex.
Ron Hornberg, is there anything you think should have been done or that you would like us to think about as a consequence of what we've learned here?
Well, going forward, and I think Dr. Bell hit it on the nose when he said that the stigma and the fact that mental health conditions, mental illnesses are frequently the subject of ridicule and shunning, make it very, very challenging and difficult to get people, young people in particular, engaged. So they will go out of, oftentimes young people will go out of their way to mask their symptoms. So certainly putting resources into community education, putting resources into school-based mental health services and university-based mental health services.
But he was already being treated. I said, this is what I'm trying to understand here. So what I kind of think you're saying is there's nothing that anyone could have done here.
These kind of situations defy easy solutions, but certainly if we did what what both Dr. Bell and I are talking about, I think we would see fewer of these kind of tragedies, because when you look at some of the other ones, these are people who had completely fallen through the cracks. Here, it's true that he was receiving some mental health treatment. However, we don't know if he was had been prescribed medication. We don't know if he was taking his medication.
Right. Right.
We don't know if he was participating in treatment in the days and weeks leading up to the tragedy.
One has to ask about the gun control question in this case, because I know that that's something on a lot of people's minds. It's certainly on the mind of the father of one of the victims here. Do you have an opinion on this whole question of at what point a person should be denied access to a gun? There is no evidence in all these guns were purchased legally. He was not in any database of persons who had been prohibited from acquiring a gun. Do you have an opinion about that?
Yeah, that again is a slippery slope. I mean, it's very easy to conclude, well, if we prohibited anybody who has a mental illness from having a gun, we could avoid these kind of situations. But the reality is how do you identify people? And B, we have to be very careful not to create further barriers to people seeking care. So Connecticut, in the wake of the Sandy Hook tragedy, passed a law that requires all people who are hospitalized to be in a database. Well, that could be a deterrent to people seeking voluntary hospitalization before their situations become emergencies. So we have to be careful.
Dr. Bell, final thought from you.
Plus,
we have about 40
plus,
seconds.
20% of the American public at some point has a psychiatric illness.
Right.
So that's a whole lot of people to be restricting.
Correct.
We only have about 20 seconds. Dr. Bell, it sounds as if you're also saying there's not a whole lot we could have done here.
I think that the family had their eyes and their hearts on this kid, and they were doing the best they could for him. But it just, even though they were monitoring him as closely as they could, which is what I think would have prevented the other ones that have happened, because the other ones were not being monitored. That's what we got to do. We got to take these people into our hearts and our lives and keep tabs on them so that they're doing okay.
Dr. Carl Bell is a staff psychiatrist at Jackson Park Hospital Family Medicine Clinic in Chicago. We reached him there. Ron Hunberg is Director of Policy and Legal Affairs at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. He was here with me in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.